Gunfire at Central Peninsula Hospital in Soldotna leaves two dead. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, November 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, another cut to halibut harvest numbers in Southeast.
It's going to be huge. I know it feels a bit like a punch in the stomach to a lot of people.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, helping customers get to the next stage through banking, loans, and retirement planning. Wells Fargo, the next stage.
A former employee at Central Peninsula Hospital in Soldotna opened fire at the hospital shortly after 10 a.m. this morning, killing one of his former bosses and wounding another before being surrounded and killed by police. KBBI's Casey Kelly has more.
Hospital spokeswoman Bonnie Nichols says the shooter, 48-year-old Joseph Marchetti, was recently fired from his job in the hospital's imaging department, but she didn't know why.
I really don't have a lot of information about him. He'd only worked here about a year, and before that moved here from Omaha, Nebraska.
The victims were Marchetti's supervisors, 55-year-old Mike Webb, who died shortly before noon, and 57-year-old Margaret Stroop, who is in stable but critical condition. Nichols says Stroop suffered multiple gunshot wounds to her chest. She was still in surgery late into the afternoon.
She is out of surgery and headed towards our intensive care unit. She lost a lot of blood, and we're awaiting more blood products from the Blood Bank of Alaska. And she is still in critical condition, but somewhat stable.
Alaska State Troopers report that Marchetti was shot and killed by police following a short standoff in the hospital parking lot. Three troopers fired their weapons during the incident. All three will be placed on administrative leave. Their names will be released after 3 days, as per Department of Public Safety policy. As of 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the hospital remained a crime scene, and Nichols said employees were beginning to cope with the day's events.
We've got a lot of support here with our spiritual care department, and we've got chaplains and mental health professionals that are briefing all the employees, and so we're doing the best we can under the circumstances.
Schools near the hospital were also locked down, and the Kenai Peninsula Borough's emergency warning system was activated to warn people to stay away from the area. The school lockdown ended at about 10:40 a.m. Another message from the borough was sent at 10:50, letting people know that the situation had been resolved. In Homer, I'm Casey Kelly.
Former State Representative Bruce Wyrock lost a decision in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals today. The Juneau Republican had been accused of soliciting a job from VECO in exchange for following the oil services company's lead on pending legislative action on a tax on the oil industry. He had originally been scheduled to go to trial in September of last year. But the Federal District Court in Anchorage ruled that evidence relating to state ethics violations could not be used in the trial. Responding to an appeal by the government, the Ninth Circuit ruled that federal law, quote, governs every public official and that the government does not need to prove an independent violation of state law. The appeals court ruled the trial court would determine whether the evidence is relevant to the federal charges. If there is no further appellate action, the case returns to the federal court in Anchorage. A new tally is in for Fairbanks State House District 7, the only remaining undecided legislative seat from November 4th's general election. Incumbent Republican Mike Kelly had a one-vote lead over Democrat challenger Carl Castle going into a count of absentee ballots yesterday. And as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, that hasn't changed.
The latest numbers show Mike Kelly maintaining a one-vote lead over Carl Castle, but the path to the new tally had a few twists and turns Tuesday. Division of Elections Director Gail Finumiai says it began with the count of 49 remaining absentee ballots for District 7.
Ballots that were received after the last counting that was done in the Fairbanks Regional Office, as well as, you know, qualified overseas ballots. And Mr. Castle received 22 votes and Mr. Kelly received 19. There were three write-in votes and five blanks.
It appeared Castle had taken a two-vote lead, but given the closeness of the race, Vanumiai called on the state board charged with reviewing all ballots, knowing discrepancies in two District 7 precincts had been discovered. She says a few ballots that got stuck in voting machines had been accidentally tallied twice.
When ballots get jammed in the optical scan unit, there are two things that can happen. There's a message that displays on the LCD screen, and it can say counted ballot jammed in reader, or it would say uncounted ballot jammed in reader. And evidently, the board and or voter did not look at that message and assumed the ballot was jammed, so they pulled it back out and fed it back through the optical scan unit again.
Elimination of the double votes put Kelly back in the lead by one, and that's where the race stands. Vanumiai says no other ballots will be counted before the election is certified next week, but that could change if a recount is requested.
Any ballots that were postmarked by election day but received after the cutoff, after the deadline to receive ballots, those ballots can be reviewed and counted during a recount according to state law.
Vanumiai says no such ballots have been received so far. A recount of the more than 10,000 District 7 votes is likely, but cannot be requested until after the election is certified. Both Mike Kelly and Carl Castle are traveling and were unavailable for comment today. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Four members of an alleged drug ring are still at large after Anchorage police and federal law enforcement arrested eight people yesterday for cocaine, meth, heroin, and firearms trafficking. More than a dozen firearms and over $100,000 in cash were seized, along with large amounts of drugs. In all, 12 people are being sought or have been arrested in conjunction to the alleged criminal activity. A federal grand jury in Anchorage indicted the 12. Attorney Christine Thorson with the U.S. Attorney's Office says it's not yet known if those arrested and are still being sought are part of a local organized gang.
Well, we know that these are 12 individuals who are moving not only a lot of drugs, heroin, methamphetamine, and cocaine, but they're also involving guns, including handguns and machine guns, in their drug operation.
Thorson says some of those arrested were arraigned in Judge Ralph Beislein's court yesterday.
We are expecting arraignment times and dates for the remaining people who are in custody to come out within the next several days.
Thorson says the four individuals still at large should be considered dangerous. The U.S. Attorney's Office for Alaska says the drug ring had been in operation since 2005. Those arrested faced minimum drug conspiracy sentences of 10 years and a $4 million fine. The possession of machine guns in connection with drug trafficking carries a mandatory 30-year consecutive sentence. Other defendants face at least 5 years in prison and a $2 million fine. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an expansion of high-speed web service in Kodiak will use renewable energy.
We are doing a solar, wind, and generator backup system.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Conservation Solutions, providing ways to measure your carbon footprint and reduce your energy consumption at AlaskaConservationSolutions.com. From resource issues to recreational activities, APRN brings you the up-to-date information you need for life in Alaska.
Army officials are reporting a Fort Wainwright soldier died in Iraq on Monday afternoon. First Lieutenant William K. Jerrigan died of injuries sustained from a non-combat-related incident at his forward operating base in Baghullah, Iraq. Jerrigan was 35 years old and from Doraville, Georgia. He was a military intelligence officer who joined the Army in July 2002 and was assigned to Headquarters and Headquarters Company, Brigade Troops Battalion, 1st Striker Brigade Combat Team, 25th Infantry Division at Fort Wainwright in April 2007. He is the third Striker Brigade soldier to die in Iraq since the 4,200 soldier unit deployed in September. The incident is under investigation and next of kin have been notified. The International Pacific Halibut Commission has announced another significant reduction in the halibut harvest next year. The cutback will be a heavy blow, especially for commercial longliners in Southeast who've seen their quotas cut steadily over the last 5 years. Lower halibut abundance in Southeast waters could also set the stage for another legal battle for charter halibut fishermen opposed to a reduction in the daily bag limit for their clients. From KCAW in Sitka, Robert Woolsey has the story.
The IPHC's preliminary catch limit recommendation for Area 2C in 2009 is 28% lower than last year. Southeast longliners will be held to about 4.5 million pounds of halibut. That's down from a high of around 10 million pounds within the last decade.
It's going to be huge.
Linda Benkin is the director of the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association.
I know it feels a bit like a punch in the stomach to a lot of people. There'll be people who will have a difficult time or will not be able to make payments on quota share that they've purchased when the quotas were quite a bit higher.
Commercial longliners in Southeast also took a double-digit hit to their quota last year. Benkin at the time stressed that commercial longliners put stock conservation as their first priority and supported the 2008 cut. The catch reductions are part of a change in the way the IPHC counts halibut. Until a couple of years ago, the commission looked at fish populations in the different areas of the Gulf separately. Having adopted now what is called a coast-wide model, the commission believes that there is a general west-to-east movement of fish as they mature. Although the shift to the coastwide model has depressed harvest limits in southeast Alaska, Benkin still believes in the science behind the new model.
I think the commission has come to the conclusion that it's not appropriate to model as if there isn't movement between the areas, but there still are some significant differences between the regions that we think need to be taken into account. But all that said, Alpha has always followed the science. We've always asked questions. We've expected rigorous answers. We've always gotten them.
The coastwide model has its skeptics, among them Earl Comstock, a Washington, D.C. attorney and former staff member of Senator Ted Stevens, who now consults for the sport charter industry. Comstock believes reducing the commercial catch limits in Southeast will increase pressure to lower the amount of halibut taken by guided sport anglers.
You know, turning to a segment of the sport fishing industry and saying, you need to reduce the amount of fish that you're going to take because we're concerned about making sure that the commercials get as much fish as humanly possible, well, that's a policy call. But that's one that we're not obviously supportive of, and we don't think that's the right answer for the economy of Southeast or for the American public as a whole.
Because the sport charter harvest is such a small percentage of the overall halibut harvest in the Gulf, Comstock believes the IPHC's adoption of the coastwide assessment model and the subsequent swing in abundance estimates is strictly a problem for the commercial fleet.
Is that the right model? We don't know. The bottom line is that's what's causing the reduction in the commercial fishing quota is not anything that the charter fleet is doing.
But commercial fishermen point to the numbers for Area 2C, or Southeast Alaska, for a different story. In 2007, the most recent year of available data, guided sport anglers landed almost 2 million pounds of halibut. Unguided and resident anglers in Southeast took another 1 million pounds. With the commercial catch now down to 4.5 million pounds for next year, the combined 3 million pound sport harvest looms large. The guided sport fleet last spring fought off in court an attempt to lower the daily bag limit on halibut to one fish per day. The rule was an effort by NOAA Fisheries to bring the Southeast charter fleet under its guideline harvest level, which it had exceeded in 2007 by roughly 1 million pounds. NOAA is currently preparing another rule, which Jay Gintner, the chief of regulatory operations in Juneau, says is an attempt to manage the sport fleet to somewhat approximate their GHL. Earl Comstock thinks any new NOAA rule that involves one fish a day could be headed for another court challenge.
If the same number of anglers show up, then you're gonna miss that target. It's just simple math. Even at one fish, they're going to miss that target.
The International Pacific Halibut Commission staff will recommend an overall reduction in the commercial harvest in the Gulf of Alaska of 6 million pounds, or around 10%. Some areas west of Kodiak in 3B and 4B will see slight increases over last year. South Central Alaska, or Area 3A, will see a decrease of 7%. But it is the Eastern Gulf, Southeast Alaska, and British Columbia that will see the largest decreases by far at 28 and 22% respectively. The only bright spot in the news is that the price of halibut remains high, around $5 a pound at the dock. But Alpha's Linda Benkin says the price is not high enough to offset the disproportionate loss of the Southeast harvest. The International Pacific Halibut Commission will meet in January to take action on this year's staff recommendation for catch limits. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Bruce Lehman, executive director of the International Pacific Halibut Commission, says the proposed reduction in commercial halibut harvest next year is based on a very substantial drop in survey data. Alaskans who want a chance to get a ticket to President-elect Barack Obama's inauguration ceremony need to act fast. Requests must go to Alaska's congressional delegation within the next few days. Overall, there are 240,000 tickets to the official swearing-in ceremony, which will take place in front of the U.S. Capitol building on Tuesday, January 20th. Most of those tickets are being distributed through congressional offices, and Alaska's delegation has only 928 tickets among them. They've already been inundated with more than five times that number of requests. The offices of both Congressman Don Young and Senator Lisa Murkowski have fielded upwards of 2,500 requests each. Senator Murkowski says the excitement from Alaskans is impressive.
It has been absolutely overwhelming. Now, keep in mind, we are only taking requests from Alaskans. These people that call up and say, well, you know, my aunt lives in Alaska, and so I need one, we are not putting them on our list. These are Alaskans who've said, I want to be part of this historical event, and can you get me a ticket?
Congressman Young's office says they've gotten lots of calls from people who are not Alaskans, but thought the office would have extra tickets because of Alaska's far distance from Washington. Young's office is fielding legitimate requests until Monday morning, but Murkowski's office is only taking requests until tomorrow. They can be submitted online. Senator Ted Stevens' office is not offering tickets since he will no longer be Alaska's senator in January. Murkowski says they'll distribute the 928 tickets in the fairest way possible and may need to use a lottery system, but she warns that people shouldn't expect to automatically get a ticket.
There's going to be many disappointed Alaskans when they learn that they were not able to get a ticket. We are hopeful that that the inaugural committee will expand capacity on the mall to accommodate more individuals.
The tickets are for standing areas outside within sight of the swearing-in ceremony. Murkowski notes that anyone attending the ceremony will go through extensive screening and stand outside for hours. But Murkowski says it's incredible to see the outpouring of enthusiasm from Alaskans.
Yeah, we are almost 4,000 miles away, and Alaskans are so excited and energized to be part of this that they're making travel plans to come back. But if people do not have reservations and they do not have a hotel, I would advise them that this is not going to happen. Apparently, everything in the district is booked and all the flights are booked.
Senator Murkowski's office expects to be able to let people know if they're getting a ticket early next month. The company that brought true high-speed telecommunications to the Kodiak Road system is now working on providing the same to six other communities in the borough. For member station KMXT, Jay Barrett has more.
Kodiak Kenai Cable Company, which is owned by the Old Harbor and Uzinki Native Corporations, connected Kodiak to the outside world with two fiber optic cables to the mainland 2 years ago. Now the company wants to provide increased bandwidth to the villages, but this time through microwave relay towers. Right now, the villages send and receive telephone, internet, cable TV, and even KMXT radio through satellite downlinks, which have speed and bandwidth limitations. Brian Kincaid, the chief operating officer of Kodiak Kenai Cable, says the company is taking on the new project by leveraging its fiber optic experience.
So as we've matured that business plan and got profits from it, we're taking that and building out a system, hopefully around the island. Our first shot is up to Sheraton Mountain to feed the villages of Uzinki and Port Lyons. And we are trying to get carriers on board as well as the Coast Guard on board to help us fund the continuation of that to surround the island completely.
He says the infrastructure atop Sheraton Mountain, about 10 miles west of Kodiak City, will cost about $2 million. The cost of the island-spanning loop is about $11 million. Like it did with the undersea fiber optic line, Kodiak Kenai Cable wants to be a provider to the providers and attract telecommunication companies to lease bandwidth on their system.
So what's going on at Sheraton Mountain is a demonstration, and really to let the carriers look at what our capabilities are. So far, it's on paper, and they love it. but we want to physically build one, and we believe that business case will stand alone, and then it's our desire to show them the capabilities we have in building those systems out.
To cope with Kodiak's notoriously inclement weather, the power of the transmitters will be higher, and the size of the receivers will be larger than systems spanning the same distance elsewhere. Powering the 7 mountaintop relay stations does pose a problem, but Kincaid says the towers will be supplied electricity through a combination of green technologies with a fuel backup.
We are doing a solar, wind, and generator backup system. And so we went out to look in the marketplace for wind turbines, and we couldn't find anything that was durable enough to live on top of the mountains in Kodiak. And so we're in the process of developing and building our own wind turbine.
Work on the Sheraton Mountain site was stalled for a few weeks because of weather, but Kincaid says he's found some tents to set up so work can continue there. He hopes to have the first leg up and running by February and begin working on other legs of the loop next summer. I'm Jay Barrett.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
And by
BP Alaska. BP is focused on the future, getting more oil out of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Alaska's gas to North America.
Increased wood burning in the Fairbanks area is causing localized air quality problems. The oil price spike that culminated this summer resulted in many area home and business owners switching from oil to wood heating, and that's putting a lot of smoke in the air. Joan Hardesty with Department of Environmental Conservation in Fairbanks says her agency regularly gets complaints.
A person from North Pole called in that he went home one night and it was real hazy outside. He woke up and he had the same smoky haze inside his house. One of the schools called in, and they'd stop their kids from going outside playing during recess because there was so much smoke in the neighborhood.
The Wood River Elementary School is situated in a densely populated neighborhood where a few residents have outdoor wood-fired boilers. Principal Star Patterson says she called DEC a couple weeks back when smoke posed a risk to students and school staff. Patterson says there was a haze of smoke in some classrooms, and a few kids with respiratory problems stayed home. High fine particulate levels due to smoke have triggered numerous air quality advisories in Fairbanks in recent weeks, and the Environmental Protection Agency is in the process of lining out a non-attainment area where emissions will be regulated. Hardesty says there's already a state law against putting out too much smoke. The state and Fairbanks Borough are teaming up to clamp down on polluters. Residents could face fines for putting out too much smoke or even be forbidden from using stoves or boilers that cannot be operated cleanly. Borough Mayor Jim Whitaker says the problem was anticipated, but the borough had to delay action.
We were faced with the very real possibility of people simply not being able to heat their homes, given the high cost of heating fuel. And also at that time, we did not have standards for outdoor wood burners. We do now have a set of standards from the EPA that can be enforced. And we will be moving an ordinance forward within the next 60 days that will provide for some very strict standards with regard to both wood stoves and outdoor wood burners.
Whitaker says it's estimated that between 1 and 2,000 outdoor wood and coal boilers are operating in the borough, as well as thousands of wood stoves. He says there may be a buyout program to help people replace polluting appliances. The mayor has made cleaning up local air a top priority for his final year in office. Whitaker says fine particulates present a proven health risk, and the pollution problem is putting the brakes on development in the area. The Southeast community of Angoon has officially changed the name of their health clinic to the Jesse Norma Jim Health Center. A dedication and renaming ceremony was held recently by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium and the Angoon Community Association. As KCAW's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock reports, the new clinic honors longtime community health aid practitioner Jesse Norma Jim, who worked in Angoon for more than 35 years.
Jesse Norma Jim was born in Angoon in 1939 to John and Nadia Gamble. She attended Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka and earned a licensed practical nurse certificate in 1960. When she went back to Angoon in 1962, she worked out of her home as a volunteer health aide and did everything from deliver babies to treating accident trauma. Her brother-in-law and the president of the Angoon Community Association, Wally Frank, says Jesse and another health aide, Barbara Johnson, who now lives in Yakutat, were the only regular medical staff in Angoon for 20 years.
I guess a lot of lives were probably saved because of her and maybe Barbara before we had regular nurses come here and doctors. They were the only source of medical opinions that was relayed to the doctors from here.
Frank says Jesse's medical opinions, however, were highly respected.
The doctor said if Jesse said they needed to go to hospital, they took him to the hospital right away. So she knew what she was doing.
When the Community Health Aid Practitioner, or CHAP, program started in 1968, Jesse was one of the first people to receive training and certification, which allowed her to finally get paid for her work. In a 2006 audio interview conducted by the CHAP program Jukebox, Jesse talks about her work in Angoon.
But there were many times when I felt like I wouldn't be able to make it, but talk myself back into it, because it is a hard job. I don't think any amount of money make up for some of the things they have to go through on that job.
Jesse retired in 2005, but she continued to help out in the clinic. In the 2006 CHAP audio interview, she admitted that it was difficult to ever leave for good.
It's kind of hard to leave. I mean, you have to have kind of like a love for taking care of people. Maybe a feeling of being needed.
Wally Frank says Jesse was definitely needed, and the community is still mourning her loss. She died in February 2007 in a house fire that also claimed the life of her grandson, Charles L. Nelson. Frank says last week's dedication was bittersweet for Angoon residents. They're happy that the Jesse Norma Jim Health Center now bears her name, but he says they still miss the woman that cared for so many people. And he says small villages should be grateful to the people who do this kind of work.
I like to urge the people to treat their health aides and their health people nice, because they're here for our benefit.
Frank says Jesse is remembered for her love of basketball, her kindness, her commitment to the people of Angoon, and her laughter. And now the clinic she fought so hard for will also carry her name. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Homer, Bonnie Sue Hitchcock and Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, and John Ryan in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer, John Prophet is our webmaster, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org. Support for APRN coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood comes from Penn Air, offering scheduled charter services throughout Alaska and the United States. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.